Thank you. Okay, so that's the topic, and I just wanted to sort of begin with a brief introduction. First, I'd just like to tell you about the choice of this topic. I mean, the mainstream issues in the nature of time and quantum gravity are relational time, or Leibniz, or causality, and then emergent time, especially in the early universe, and time as an operator value distribution, quantum clocks, and emerging time from a timeless framework. Now, these are the kinds of issues that are close to my heart, and I've thought about them over the years. But I thought that this time I would choose another slightly different topic, basically because there are many other talks on these topics up here. And this topic is motivated a little bit by particle physics considerations, which are not otherwise represented in the workshop program. And so that's why I chose this to speak on the time reversal. And the focus here, I just want to emphasize, because there's always a confusion about time reversal, I mean, often confusion about time reversal. The focus here about the T violation, the time reversal violation that I'll talk about, has to do with the fundamental laws of nature. It doesn't have to do with, this is unrelated to the traditional arrow of time that emerges in statistical mechanics considerations. For example, if you have a gas and if you open the in half the part and you open the in half of the box and you open the partition and you wait, then of course the gas fills the whole box. So the gas goes from one half to the full box up here. But it's very rare to see the whole, we never see the gas in the whole box going to fill only half of it. And that is kind of the arrow of time. But that arrow of time has to do with the fact that there are many more microstates compatible with the final macrostate than the initial macrostate. The microscopic laws in classical physics, namely Newton's laws, are in fact time reversal invariant. So I'm really here focusing on the microscopic laws and not about the statistical nature that we're talking about. Now, over the last several years, there has been tremendous experimental progress, actually 55 years. And that tell us that in fact, at a fundamental level, you know, that fundamental force or interaction of nature breaks the time reversal invariance. And more importantly for this workshop, this is a genuinely quantum feature associated with time, because you know, in classical physics, or the fundamental laws that we know of don't break time reversal. But now, as was sort of emphasized in talks yesterday, if you look at the passage from observations to the conclusion that we draw up here, then in order to do that, one has to use some theoretical framework in order to interpret the observations. And this theoretical framework typically uses detailed Minkowski quantum field theory. And I mean, the general expectation that these key elements of the Minkowski quantum field theories will not survive when gravity is included. And therefore, we should really look at it from a different perspective. Of course, if we had a quantum theory of gravity, we'll just look at it from a point of view of quantum theory of gravity, but we don't have a full quantum theory of gravity. And so we can ask the question slightly differently, namely, while in the usual framework, all these Minkowski quantum field theory is used, we can just take the different point of view and saying that, well, reanalyze the usual framework and see if in fact what elements are essential to draw the conclusion of T violation from actual observations. And it turns out, so that's the part that is the main point of this talk up here. And it turns out that there is much excess baggage in the current analysis. In other words, we know we use Hilbert spaces, operators, unitary operators, anti-unitary operators, make various assumptions. And in fact, very little of that is really necessary to draw this conclusion. And therefore, there's a minimalistic framework, which I'm going to call general mechanics. And in fact, this general mechanics then provides perhaps some guidance also for quantum gravity considerations, such as, you know, for example, in loop quantum gravity, what one should aim for would be this kind of a general framework. Those are the minimum requirements that we should really aim for. So the organization of the talk is that I got It's about first, in the first part up here, I'm going to tell you about the just two experiments because the talk is, our time is limited. And I don't want to go into too many technicalities. So I'll just tell you about the experiments and the theoretical reasoning that is currently used. I hope particularly the younger researchers and students will sort of pay attention because everything is extremely explicit. And the power here is really that details of the Hamiltonians or details of the interactions are not really necessary. And that I think is the beauty of this whole idea that people are used to conclude about T invariance. In fact, the first experiments for T invariance when they were done, we did not really know what the Lagrangian or the Hamiltonian was that gave rise to what the precise expectation was that gave rise to this this particular phenomena, which we used to conclude this. Now, in the second part, then I will sort of go to the general mechanics, which is the minimal framework motivated by quantum gravity considerations, and that suffices to conclude that there is T violation just from the current experiments and within generalized mechanics and particular generalized quantum mechanics. And then there is a discussion, short one, in which I would like to sort of illustrate how the principal structures that are used in the general mechanics can actually arise starting from quantum mechanics. In fact, ordinary quantum mechanics seems to provide us with a direction for the generalization, and that is what I would like to talk about. This whole analysis was motivated by discussions with philosophers of science, particularly John Ehrman at Pittsburgh, Thomas Pashby, who is now in Chicago, and in particular, Brian Roberts, who I think is in this conference, who is following the footsteps of Kuhn, and he is actually in the London School of Economics, London School of Economics up here. And he's a philosopher of science, and he started some ideas about T invariance. He's an expert on that, and that is what made me start thinking about this. So the violation of T invariance, the first part. So there are two parts in this first part. One is really A, which is the indirect evidence, and then the direct evidence. The indirect evidence comes from the decays of mesons, which are called K0 long mesons. And I realize that this audience is not familiar with particle physics, perhaps, and therefore I'm going to use very elementary ideas and explain as I go along how various conclusions are drawn. So what we have is really the following, that this is this particular meson, and its lifetime is about 50 nanoseconds, and it decays. And the principal decay mode is in the three pi ions, pi plus, pi minus, and pi zero, and there's a prominent one. And this is what people had observed, and they were all happy, because even after the discovery of the parity violation in 1956, it was assumed that the time reversal invariance was an exact symmetry of fundamental laws of nature. And as we will see, this particular decay, the second decay channel, which occurs only with a branching ratio of 1 in 1,000, is actually, it was assumed that it cannot occur, it is forbidden. But then, Cronin and Fitch, Jim Cronin and Val Fitch in 1964, so about 8 years after the P violation, discovered that in fact, this does occur with a branching ratio of 10 to the minus 3. And this was a big surprise. And therefore, people concluded that there is a T violation. Now, this is an observation. We start from here, and there are two decay channels, and then we conclude that there is a T violation. Well, obviously, it's not obvious why there should be a T violation. So the question is that how does this profound conclusion then follow? And what is it? For that, we need a theoretical framework, which is, of course, built on the assumptions of Pinkowski and quantum field theory in standard discussions. So what one does in standard discussions is the following. One uses here two steps. The assumptions in the first step are simple, that kinematics that is used, quantum kinematics, is in ordinary quantum mechanics. There are Hilbert spaces and operators, all linear. And then the symmetries, the charge conjugation, parity, and CP. There's no T here, and for good reasons. I'll see them explain in a minute. It is assumed that these are represented by unitary operators on the Hilbert space. And then it is assumed, so these are the key assumptions, that the dynamical assumptions, if you like, that the interactions that bind the quarks into kaons are CP invariant. So first of all, I have to tell you what I mean by that. So we got the quarks that come up here are strange quarks, and that is why these kaons were not sort of known in the early days of particle physics. And so first of all, you can make a bound state of the down quark and the strange quark and the S bar, the antiparticle of the strange quark, and also with the antiparticle of the down quark and the strange quark. So this is a meson, the total spin is zero. This is another meson. And so K naught and K naught bar, these are the mesons. And these are eigenstates of the strangeness operator, because you see the strangeness is pure here, is by convention plus one here and minus one here. And now one can, what one does in this analysis is always starts with the fundamental fermions, in which case, in this case, there are quarks. And then by various considerations, one can assign the behavior. I mean, one can, because they're fermions, they have a certain charge, they have various features, one can consistently assign what happens to the individual quarks under these operations, CP and CP. And from that, and the assumption that in fact, whatever binds the quarks is a CP invariant, one just comes to the conclusion that CP operating on K naught is equal to K naught bar. So it flips, and CP operating on K naught bar is K naught. So this is the conclusion that is drawn by just basis of kinematical and conventions of certain phase conventions and the properties of the actual quarks up here. But now these are not the things that are actually observed in nature. So this is not invariant under CP. I mean, this is mapped into each other under CP. The eigenstates of CP are really obtained by just superposing them, just like, you know, what we do with spins up here. And this is with a minus sign, and that is why the eigenvalues of CP is minus one. If I take a plus sign up here, I would get another particle, which is the short-lived kaon, and then the eigenvalue would be plus one. But we are looking at eigenvalue minus one up here. So K long has an eigenvalue minus one. So the third point is that the interactions that bind quarks into kaons are CP invariant, and that tells us that the eigenvalue under CP of the long K long bar meson is actually minus one. And finally, there is a scattering operator, and one assumes, which is giving you dynamics, and one assumes that dynamics actually commutes with CP. And the point up here is that if this happens, then there is a contradiction with observations. So therefore, some of the assumptions here must be wrong. And since the dynamical assumptions are these two, at least one of them must be wrong. And it turns out that both of them are wrong. The interactions are not CP invariant, and the scattering operator is also not CP invariant. Okay, so now what is the proof here? It's very elementary. I mean, all of you sort of already see the proof, I think. One is that if I take, you need one more ingredient to know about this. The ingredient here is that this P's, the pions themselves are CP invariant, and therefore CP, under CP, the pion, the two pi, let me start from there. Under CP, each pion picks up a minus sign. There are two of them here. Therefore, under CP, the two pions are invariant, and the three pion system picks up a minus sign up here. And now it's clear that if, in fact, this is what is happening, and if I start with something which is odd under CP, and if it is supposed to decay into something which is even under CP, that is not possible. And the proof is this one line, which is that you start with the K long applied with a scattering operator, and you are trying to calculate the transition amplitude here to go to pi plus pi minus. But then because of the unitarity of CP, I can write here CP and CP on both sides. But CP operator pi plus pi minus is pi plus minus. So this gives me a plus sign, but CP operating on K not long is minus. Therefore, it gives me a minus sign. Therefore, this quantity is equal to minus itself. And therefore, we get a contradiction. And therefore, if this were true, then this transition would be forbidden. But in nature, we see this transition with a branching ratio of 1 to 1,000, and therefore CP is violated. So that is the conclusion, that the assumption that the interactions that binds quarks into this and or that cause decay our CP invariant, that assumption will tell us that this decay is forbidden, but it does occur. And because it occurs, then we conclude that that CP is actually not symmetric. Well, but what does it have to do with T invariants? Well, as most of you know, that if we assume in addition the standard assumption of quantum field theory, namely relativistic quantum field theory, locality, spin statistics, the Poincaré group is unitarily implemented. There's a full Poincaré group, including the discrete parts. And the vacuum is Poincaré invariant. By the way, if you don't get this, this is the French way of writing Poincaré, because there's a point here and there's a carré here. So this is a Poincaré. So therefore, the statement therefore is that, but we just saw that in fact, under CP, the S matrix is not invariant. And therefore, the statement is that if it were invariant under T, in other words, if it commuted with T, then we would have contradiction with the CPT invariance of the S matrix, because T is invertible. So you just expand out CPT here into two terms and then conclude that, in fact, this not equal to zero implies this not equal to zero. So thus the statement is that this decay is a T violation in the fundamental law, which is really shocking, right? This is the first time in after that mankind has discovered fundamental laws in which the time reversal invariant is actually violated. But of course, provided nature is described by local relativistic quantum field theory. And this restriction, however, is too restrictive for to include gravity, because of all these assumptions you don't expect to be fulfilled in the quantum theory of gravity. But then there is a second and more compelling argument for the T violation, and this is a direct evidence for T violation. And this was the first experiment, was in 1998 with CP Clear in CERN, which really has to do with oscillations of K naught and K naught bar, the same K naught and K naught bar that we began with, which are eigenstates of the parity operator, the eigenstates of the strangeness operator that we saw up here. So one uses those, K naught bar. And then in 2012, the kind of the next generation, if you like, of this kinds of mesons, namely B naught and B naught bar, B. So these were used to conclude the same, to conclude the T violation. So the important thing is that we now do not pass through CPT, and therefore we don't really need axioms of relativistic quantum field theory, which is very striking for me. Already in the previous case, it was very striking for me that in fact, one did not know anything about details of the S matrix or the Hamiltonian or the Lagrangian, and we could still conclude the violation of T invariance. And now we don't even need CPT. So what happens is in the CP Lear observations, what one finds is that this part, there are oscillations between K naught and K naught bar, but the probability of transition from K naught to K naught bar is different from that for a transition from K naught bar to K naught. And the property is that each K naught and K naught bar, they are eigenstates or T operator with eigenvalue plus one. And as I said before, this is all obtained using starting with fundamental quarks and then assigning them appropriate behavior under the discrete under T and CP, and then deducing this, assuming that whatever binds quarks into these particles preserves the symmetry. Now, there is, however, a key difference at the kinematical level, which is really important in the proof as well, with respect to CP and CP. And all of you know that, namely that time reversal is represented by an anti-unitary operator, not by a unitary operator. So that is to say, T operating on a linear combination of two states, for example, is not this alpha and alpha, alpha one and alpha two are complex numbers, they don't come out, but I need complex conjugation. And also it's anti-linear and it's anti-unitary, because if I take T phi and T psi up here, then I don't get phi psi, but I have to flip phi psi. I have to take a complex conjugate up here. Now, most of us are very, very familiar with ordered standard quantum mechanics and we're very used to use unitary operator, linear operator, but we are not very so familiar with anti-unitary operators. But it's true that anti-unitary operators also admit adjoints. You can just use the Rice theorem to show that the continuity with respect to one argument of the wave function of the inner product. And then, and to conclude that in fact the T dagger exists. And again, T dagger T is equal to T dagger is equal to one. And in fact, for the operation T, the T dagger is just equal to T. Okay, so T is represented by an anti-unitary operator. And then the third assumption is the same as before, namely that T is a dynamical symmetry, as we had before assumed that CP is a dynamical symmetry. But now here, what it translates to is somewhat different. It is not TS equal to ST, but S to the minus one T. And this is just because this is a time evolution operator. And recall that the time evolution operator normally is written like this, for example. And then if I do TT minus one, then of course, then this sign actually changes because T itself changes, assuming that the Hamiltonian is T invariant, then this sign changes up here. And that is why we get this is equal to minus T, U minus T, and therefore we get here S minus one up here. And then finally, there's an important assumption here. We did not need this last time that S is a unitary operator. We just needed it to be mapping from the incoming to outgoing states, which we assume to commute with CP. But here we are assuming it's a unitary operator. And now just we can go ahead. I just summarize the assumptions here so that you can see the proof. The assumption is that T is anti-unitary. So this is what the anti-unitary means. And then the other assumption is that it's a dynamical symmetry and S is a unitary operator. So if you give me any two-state sign phi, then I can calculate the transition amplitude for S for psi to be mapped with S by the outgoing state phi up here. But then I can just use the anti-unitarity of T to put your T, except that then I have to flip these two arguments. That's what we saw in the anti-unitarity. So this is equal to T times S psi times T times phi. S minus one times T is just equal to TS up here. S minus one itself is just equal to S dagger because of unitarity. So I just get S dagger T, and I can take now the S on the other side up here, and I just get T psi with S T phi. So what we see is that the probability of psi decaying to phi is the same as probability that T phi decaying into T psi. So transition probability for T to phi, psi to phi is the same as T phi to T psi. Now, if you take psi to be kaon and phi to be anti-kaon, and recall that T phi, T times and kaon, T operating on kaon is anti-kaon is anti-kaon, and then T operating on kaon is kaon up here, then we conclude that under assumption, the decay from kaon to K bar should be the same as the decay from the K bar to K. But in nature, one finds that the decay rates are different, and therefore there's this T violation. We did not assume relativistic quantum field theory or Poincaré invariance or locality for this argument of T violation. And therefore, that is really very nice. And the argument is strong and is very appealing. But we did use anti-unitarity of the T operator. Very critically here, we saw the anti-unitarity of T operator here. And here we saw the unitarity of the S matrix very strong. So the theoretical underpinning, just repeating myself, the theoretical underpinning used to conclude that there is a T violation in fundamental interactions is remarkably general. You don't need to know what the Hamiltonian is, what the interaction is, what the Lagrangian is, etc. But this argument did assume linear Hilbert space structure of quantum mechanics, unitarity of dynamics, and the subtle anti-unitarity of the T operator, of the time reversal operator. Now, it's not clear that all of these features will survive in quantum gravity. And I will mention at the concrete ideas for generalization for the quantum mechanics for quantum gravity, which would say that some of these ideas are not likely to be valid. And the simplest examples are generalized quantum mechanics, but this very simplest example is really that it keeps the kinematical structure of quantum mechanics the same, but in fact changes the quantum evolution equation. This is the nonlinear Schrodinger equations of Birulla and Weinberg. And then in that case, the assumption that you've got unitary dynamics is actually violated. And some things like that would actually happen. I mean, still the probabilities is conserved. In other words, a state is going to, it's not, doesn't change under time evolution, but the operator is not unitary. Already in part B, because it's not unitary, it's in particular not linear operator. Already in part 2B, with direct T violation, we saw that the assumptions needed to go from observations to the startling conclusion about the T violation are really can be streamlined. You don't need, you know, the all machinery of quantum mechanics and all Hamiltonian, et cetera. You can just make a very general argument and we can streamline it in general and ask the question whether under the generalized scheme, observations will still let us conclude that there is a T violation. And the answer is going to be in the affirmative. So what is the minimalist framework? I mean, it's ridiculously simple. And of course, classical mechanics and quantum mechanics are special cases of this framework. The minimal framework is that there is a set S of states. So at the moment, of course, it's just a set. I mean, presumably one would have to add a little more structure to it, but one doesn't have to be a linear structure or linear Hilbert space. And the states, elements of this S, I'm going to write them as sigma. So sigma is a state of the system up here. And in quantum mechanics, we can have psi, for example, or the density matrix. And we take, if they're both normalized, then they will qualify as the state sigma. Then the statement is that the S up here is equipped with an overlap map. So this is the short form of the inner product, but we don't need a inner product. We only need kind of a probability function, namely, it's a map from the states to itself. So to given any two states, I get a number, and the number is between 0 and 1. So the overlap between sigma and the condition is that the overlap between sigma and sigma prime is equal to the overlap between sigma prime and sigma. And of course, an example of this is realized in quantum mechanics, that the overlap map is just trace of two density matrices, or you take this whole thing squared. The important thing is that what is being used here is that this whole thing squared and not the inner product itself. Then the thing is that the third assumption is a dynamical assumption, which is that we're going to have a dynamical map S. And now I'm going to consider two copies of the set S of states, the space of states, the initial and the final one. And I got a dynamical map from the initial to the final states up here, which preserves this overlap function, right? So sigma prime and sigma, if you give me two initial states, and I can look at the initial overlap function, theta I here, I is important. Then if I take their dynamical evolution, S times sigma prime I and S times sigma I, then the overlap between them in the final space of states is equal to what we started out with. And what this means is basically, we are going to interpret this as being probability, the overlap map. So probability that sigma I goes to sigma prime f, that is just going to be given by theta f of sigma prime f, the final one, and s times sigma I. So that is what it really is. This is very minimal assumption. And then finally, symmetries. If it is a symmetry like C, P, or CP, which I can just call R for short, these were unitary ones. So in this case, we're just saying that if I take two states in the initial state or in the final final states or initial states, then if I apply R to it, then the overlap map is preserved. So R times sigma prime is equal to R times sigma, sigma. So that is what one is assuming, and similarly for the final states up here. But for T is going to be a map not from SI to SI and SF to SF, but from SI to SF, right? T is always reverses time, so from initial states to final states, or final states to initial states. And then what we are going, we are, but the condition we are asking is the same, namely, if you give me two states with the initial overlap, O1, then the final overlap between the if I apply T to this one, then I'll get a final state. Then I'll get a state in the final Hilbert space. If I apply T to this one, I'll get a state in the final set of states. Then the two should be equal to each other. So, and now I'm going to ask, there's a statement that this definition that T is a dynamical symmetry, if and only it has this property, and that is the same property that we had seen before. So the important thing is that in the general mechanics, the considerations for the considerations in the first part we had to do with the CP violation, they go through in a very straightforward manner. So I won't bother to show that here. And I will consider the more interesting case of T violation itself. So now the thing that we want to show here is the following. We suppose that T is a dynamical symmetry. So probability for sigma I to go to sigma prime F. So now I'm going to think of the, just for simplicity of notation, if I start with the state sigma I, its final state and the dynamics is going to be called sigma I. And similarly, sigma prime I evolves to sigma prime. So I start with sigma I, the probability that I am in a state sigma prime F is given by, the result that this will be equal to the probability that I start with the time reverse of sigma prime. So this will be initial state. And then I arrive at the time reverse of sigma, right? So this is what is the result that I'm going to show now, just from our assumption. And then the argument is extremely straightforward. In this direction, what I'm using is the property of the S matrix. I start with this particular overlap function, this thing up here. I start with this overlap function up here. I'll arrive at this. I start with this overlap function in the initial Hilbert space. And then I apply the S operator, because this was the property of the S operator. And then I use the symmetry of the theta, right? So in going from here to here, all that happened was that this I changed to F up here. In going from here to here, these can be flipped because theta was symmetric up here. And in going from here to here, we use just the definition of what sigma prime F is. Sigma prime F is just equal to S times sigma. And on this channel, I'm going to use the properties of T. Here I use the properties of S, here I use the property of T. So by the property of T, then we know that this overlap function is equal to T times sigma I times T times sigma prime I. But that is the definition of sigma prime F, just tells me that sigma prime F is equal to S to the minus one sigma prime F. And then the dynamical symmetry, the idea that this is a dynamical symmetry, tells me T times S minus one is S times T minus one up here. And therefore, I started with some quantity up here, and that is equal to this quantity as well as this quantity. Therefore, the Brown transition probability is equal to the red one. But this one is exactly the probability to go from sigma I to sigma prime I. And this is the probability to go from the initial state, which is T minus one sigma prime F, to the state sigma. And now I just use for the initial state either the kaons or the anti-kaons. So it just says the probability to go from kaon to anti-kaon is equal to the time probability of time reverse anti-kaon to time reverse kaon. But time reverse anti-kaon is the same as kaon, and time reversal is the same as anti-kaon, and time reverse of kaon is the same as that. And therefore, I conclude the probability of transition from K to K bar is the same as that from K bar to K. But observations say it's not the case, and therefore, it's not a dynamical symmetry. Now, look at you can just see the contrast between the two proofs that we had up here. In this case, we had to use the unitarity, anti-unitarity, and the unitarity of S matrix, anti-unitarity of the T operator, etc. Here, we didn't have any of that. We just had primitive notions of symmetries and primitive notions of dynamics preserving the probabilities. So the minimalistic framework suffices to conclude from observations that whatever the fundamental laws are govern KK bar, then in fact the we can conclude that T is violated, and what we need is just these fundamental objects that are thrown down up here. Standard quantum mechanics provides them with a lot of excess baggage, Hilbert space, not just the space sets S, scalar product, not just overlap function theta, anti-unitary operator T, not just one-to-one onto map on the space of states, preserving theta, and unitarity of S, and not just one-to-one onto mapping preserving its theta. So Pitaki quantum theory could realize its minimum ingredients via generalization of standard quantum mechanics. And so finally, in the last few minutes, I just want to give you an example of this. And the motivation here comes from what happens when we go to spatial relativity to general relativity. The first step was really Minkowskian formulation of spatial relativity up here. In the spatial relativity formulation that given by Einstein, we did not have really a geometrical way of looking at it, but we made a Minkowski gave us a geometrical way and told us that space-time was an affine linear structure, and that went to nonlinear structure up here. And the hope is, the question is then, perhaps in quantum gravity, the Hilbert space might become a nonlinear manifold, and linear antilinear mapping would become a spatial diffeomorphism. And a concrete illustration in this direction, as I said, is like the first step that Minkowski took to take standard spatial relativity and cast in the geometrical language, and I'm doing the same thing here. And what I'm normally we think of spaces belong to Hilbert space, but there's really a rays in the Hilbert space, and these rays form a Kähler manifold. So the space of states, S up here, doesn't have to be linear, can be a manifold. The overlap function is usually written like that, but this function actually turns out to be a overlap square up here. That turns out to be precisely a certain function, they say in the cos squared, of the geodesic distance between two points. So states are points up here, and the geodesic distance between them, cos squared of that, gives me this. So this is in standard quantum mechanics. I'm not changing anything up here. I'm just reformulating what we normally do on a Kähler manifold. Normally we do it in the Hilbert space. I'm just doing it on the Kähler manifold, which is a space of rays. Symmetries up here, CPT, etc. They are just diffeomorphisms on this Kähler structure up here. The self-adjoint operators, which preserve certain structure, namely the Kähler structure. And the self-adjoint operators up here, they, in this picture, they are just functions, namely via expectation values. They're just functions on the space of states, and the commutators between self-adjoint operators become points or brackets on this infinite dimensional space. There's a Kähler space, so it is a symplectic structure. It's an infinite dimensional Kähler space. So all the standard quantum mechanical structure can be formulated in this, and in fact, more succinctly in this language up here. And because it really is space of rays up here. And therefore the kinematical structure of general mechanics is concretely realized in this geometrical way of looking at ordinary quantum mechanics. And what about dynamics? Well, normally we've got Schrodinger equation, or if you like the evolution equation, this could be quantum field theory. And here the statement is that the evolution, which maps states in the scalar manifold to another state in the Kähler manifold, is just the symplectic mapping. It's just the Hamiltonian flow on this S. I don't need to know about unitarity. I don't need to know anti-unitarity. It just is that. And the symmetries are just discrete or continuous diffeomorphisms preserving the Kähler structure that I had already said up here with the Hamiltonian. So the hope is that maybe what we need, even ordinary quantum mechanics can be written in a geometrical language, just as Minkowski formulated spatial relativity in a geometrical language. Then Einstein reformulated, Einstein generalized this to make the manifold a genuine manifold and metric, a genuine curved metric and so on. And the idea up here is that maybe that is what we need to do. We need to actually generalize the structure, maybe keep some of them, maybe we keep the Kähler manifold structure, but don't take the Kähler manifold to be the trivial one, which came from a Hilbert space, but some other manifold. And therefore, if such a thing is possible, then we would still be able to conclude that there is T values. So just last sentence, which is that this minimal framework, if you like, what is up here, could be arrived at in even starting with standard, generalizing standard quantum mechanics. And when we are doing various things for quantum gravity, perhaps we should keep this in mind. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor Eshtika. I think we're more or less out of time for questions. So perhaps if people have questions, they could record them and keep them for the discussion section, and we might move on to the next talk, if that's okay.
That's okay, unless there's a short question, but that's fine with me.
Unless anyone has a really short question.
Let's see, there's something in the chat box. Is there something in the chat? Rovelli has raised a hand, but okay. Chat box, okay. That's a general remark about Poincaré. So we can just postpone it to the discussion section. Thank you.